Hello, you're about to listen to the UCB Theater podcast. This episode is an interview with Ian Roberts, which is great, and you will enjoy a lot. Just wanted at the top to apologize for a slight technical mishap we had. We did this over Skype since Ian's in LA and we're in New York, and towards the end, there's two brief sections where his voice gets a little murky. And basically, we didn't know how to repair that. But the conversation is so interesting, we didn't want to leave it out. So we just have the interview in total. And again, I just want to apologize for a couple of these spots where it's a little bit difficult to discern that they're towards the end. But the interview overall is great, and we think you're going to like it. And we want to keep practicing our Skype skills so that we can interview a lot of other cool people who are not immediately in the New York area. Okay, that's it. Enjoy the interview, and thanks very much.
Hi, welcome to the UCB podcast, episode 34, right? Is that where we are?
I have no idea.
It's either 34 or 35. We'll have to look at that. Sitting next to me is Will Hines.
And sitting next to me is John Frusciante. Hello, John.
Hello, Will. And we're very excited to have the UCB's Ian Roberts with us via Skype today.
Thanks for being here, Ian.
Thank you for having me.
So Ian, of course, is one of the founding members of the UCB, one of the founders of the theater, great improviser and teacher. And has done a bunch of other stuff, and we're here to talk with him a little bit about how he got into improv and some stuff he's been working on and whatever else we managed to wander into. Right, John?
That's right. So, Ian, why don't we just start off? Tell us how you got into improv, how your introduction to it came about.
I'd say if I went the most basic, first improv I ever did was probably just intuitive without knowing it was improv. Would be, you know, most of the friends I hung out with, we did bits, and my brother and I used to do bits.
Right.
I remember when we were kids, you know?
Yeah.
And then first formal introduction would have been through straight acting. I did a summer program with some place called the National Theater Institute, which it sounds a lot better. No, National Shakespeare Conservatory. That's what it was, National Shakespeare Conservatory.
Right.
sounds better than it. Than it actually was. It was up at some camp in Kerhonkton, New York, and they did improv, you know, for acting, gave you scenarios. And I remember that was like where I really excelled. I'm like, oh, okay, this is good. And then I came back after that summer at another program, which was at a place called the National Theater Institute in Connecticut. I was at a little college, Grinnell College, and they only had one acting class. So I came back thinking, I want to start this kind of self-taught acting class. We'll get all people that are interested in theater, and we'll run a class where we'll just critique each other and do exercises from books. And I wanted to do that. Then this girl, Jessica Thebus, who had worked with the Piven Theater Company out in Evanston, Illinois, she wanted to start up a kind of like a student-run theater thing, but she wanted to do story theater and improv, which is what they did at the Piven Theater Company. They did like worked up productions out of improv.
Right.
And so she said, if we both do this, it'll split things. So why don't you join my thing? I said, okay, because I'd like this little bit of improv I did. And so we did set games and then got into open improv, you know, sort of like what we do, long form stuff.
Right.
And then we formed a group called Proteus, and that was at my college. And then when I got out of college, I went to.
Was that name Proteus?
Proteus, yeah.
Why that name?
And then, I don't know, someone came up with, I think it's some god who could change his form or something.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't my name, but I remember it seemed like a good name for an improv group. And then I went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin for no better reason than I was dating a girl from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. When I graduated from college, I followed her out there. Okay. She broke up with me in 2 months, and I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for 3 years. But and there I did comedy sports, and that was for about 2 years or 3 years. And
did you run across like Dan Harmon or Rob Schraber, those guys? Were you out there at the same time as them?
Who is it?
Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub. Do the names ring a bell? I know that Dan Harmon is the guy that created Community and Channel 101 in LA. And I think they're from with Milwaukee Comedy Sports.
Oh, really?
It might be after you.
From Milwaukee Comedy Sports. I did a scene with him on Reno. We did a scene together.
Okay.
I can't remember his name.
Sorry.
But, I'm not sure. I might know those guys. I'm not sure if our paths crossed or not.
Okay.
But, and with that, you know, where I did well was when we did rehearsals, because we would do open improv, basically long-form stuff. And then the other stuff, I was serviceable, you know. I played all the time and played those theater games. But, you know, I couldn't really shine in that. And there were guys that were just amazing at that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I was serviceable enough that, you know, I did the shows all the time and made enough money to take off and go around Europe for a couple months. But, and then I moved to Chicago I thought I'd get to in the second city in 2 weeks, you know, and
right.
I didn't. But I found Improv Olympic, and at the time it was at a place called McMahon's, and it was in the basement of this place. And I know in the first show I saw Dave Koechner and Kevin Dorff. And I'm like, oh, this is, because I've always wanted to do
right.
just open improv, but I've never found a place that did what I did best. We'd do it in rehearsal, we'd do it, you know, and then I saw that. I'm like, okay, I got to get into this organization.
Right.
And then,
yeah.
you know, studied with Sharna Halpern and Bel Close, and eventually ended up getting on The Family, which is where, you know, the high point of my improv career, as far as, you know, rehearsing all the time, doing some really, couple of really cool shows.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, got involved with the Upright Citizens League, you know.
Yeah,
founded
right.
that with those guys. So that's my long-winded
that's not too long-winded for a good swath of your life.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the initial formation of the UCB, because I know it kind of went through a couple of phases. Or I feel like it was like more of a sketch group at times, and then maybe even more of like a larger than sketch, like a performance group, and the lineup changed a little bit here or there. I'm curious about the earliest formation of it.
It was always just a comedy group, because they were all concept shows. It was virtual reality, and in that it was about half the show was improvising with the audience. We'd pull an audience on stage. And the way we did it was they always were the empowered person in the scene.
Okay.
So if you did something at the White House, they'd be the president.
And what
if
was that
you
show?
That was called Virtual Reality.
Okay.
At the time, that was brand new. Like, there were articles about it, and they were having, you know, I remember Betzer had gone to Vegas, and while he was tripping on acid, I'd gotten in. One of the first ever virtual reality things. He got up on a platform and they put the goggles on him.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't see anything. I'm just green. And he was looking down the floor. And they said, look up. And he looks up and all these robots are facing him and start shooting at him. You know? but so by, you know, reading about it and Betzer getting exposed to it, we did this show, virtual reality, where we'd bring up audience members. So we'd do sketches for half the show. Experiential, like the whole audience involved, we go out on the street and do a Thanksgiving dinner where every time you passed food, you threw a basketball across the street to the other people, and we were all on different corners of the street, and Horatio Sands would walk across, would get angry at one of the family members and storm across the street, and then Adam McKay would be in my car doing another bit that we did, and he would come and hit Horatio, and the whole audience would think that Horatio Sands got hit by a car. And then we run over him, and he'd get up and dance away back into the theater. So it's like a lot of stuff. We took people out of the theater and took them to McKay's apartment, which was a ground floor apartment, and watched a murder happen through the window. We took them out on the street and then ended the show by throwing popping fresh dough at them, and then drove away and never came back. It was all kinds of. We did a suicide where we threw a dummy off a 10-story building in Wicker Park. So all kinds of. So that was the first show. It was a lot of, you know, and we did a conference on the future of happiness, which was just three of us giving lectures on different kinds of like self-help gurus. We did one of the most straightforward sketch shows at that time was called UCB TV, and that one we used the movie techniques because we had been working on the movie with the family and improv, and so we did these scenes that needed a lot of description.
Yeah.
And we sort of did that.
Now I'm curious, at that time when you're doing these shows, like, how did it, what was the context like? I mean, what did other people view it as? Were you guys like small-time people on the scene who were sort of like just really trying something ambitious? Were you already like established people at I.O.? But and maybe
we were established people at I.O., but that meant nothing. I mean, I.O. was pretty small. It's gotten pretty big, but when we did it, it was 3 nights a week, I think it was. Maybe four, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, above, in the top of a bar called the Wrigley Side.
Yeah.
I think the audience was never bigger than about 40 people.
Yeah.
And there were only four teams total, two house teams and two, maybe it got up to two house teams and four, whatever, second string teams. But yeah, we were kind of like, definitely by the end, you know, the best team at I.O. And then Upright Citizens Brigade was, we had a small fan base that loved what we did, but I mean, very, very small, you know.
Yeah.
Chicago improv and sketch is so big, it's just a million shows going on.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah. I think we were doing really interesting stuff, but it was always in these little dives. The first place was at a coffee bar called Kill the Poets. And the joke with us is that our places would just get closed down. If we'd show up one night and there'd be a sign up that the city had closed the place down. That's what happened to that place. Then we did another place, the Rudely Elegant, which was, in general, a gay theater. You know, it was all gay productions. And and we, you know, we did a show there. The joke was, it's not the Rudely Elegant, it's the Rudely Elegant. That was the... And that place got closed down. That used to be our promo picture, with us sitting around the sign that said the city of Chicago is closed.
Down. That sign is hanging at the theater, or that picture's hanging at the theater.
Yeah, that was our promo publicity shot.
At what time, like at that time you're doing these shows, was like UCB like your main thing? I feel like people who are at that stage of like their comedy careers are usually doing like a bunch of stuff. Like you were in the family, you also had UCB, you were probably doing other things, even if they were just one-offs. But did you guys have a feeling?
I did a few other things, some specialty improv projects. I did, Adam McKay directed a dramatic improv show called Invisible Rails. I did that. You know, I can't remember if I ever ended up performing it, but a mask improv show with Shauna Halpern, I definitely rehearsed it. I might have ended up not doing the performances. And then two times I bagged on improv for a little bit to go do plays.
Right.
I did something called Savage in Limbo, and did another one, Beirut. And it was funny because that was me thinking, I got to do something that's going to lead to... I could get work professionally, you know. Right. I did it two times. Like, I just don't like this stuff as much. It's not as much fun. And in Milwaukee, I've done a lot of plays. I did about probably 7 plays.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I wanted to act, and it took me a while to put the two things together. Because really, my thing had always, you know, the way I joked around, spent my time in high school. But I was trying to say, you know, I was trying to make what I did naturally into something I thought could be a job. And
right.
All I saw was acting. And then at a certain point, I just decided to like happiness. Like, you know what? Whatever happens, happens. This is what I like. Why do I keep on going away and trying to push myself in these things that aren't as much fun? You know, I never bagged on the UCB. I never didn't do one of the UCB shows.
Right.
But I did take off from the family for a little bit and go do a couple of plays, but it was two times in Chicago, and I said, okay, I'm done. You know, I'm just going to, wherever this goes, it goes. If it goes nowhere, it goes nowhere. And if it goes somewhere, I'm in, you know, but I just wanted to enjoy myself in the present. And now, you know, people always ask me, what's your name? advice would be, one, don't try to join the winning team. Create the winning team. You know, a lot of people, they don't want to, because Second City, that's why I went out to Chicago. I wanted to get in the Second City. I did two auditions, and I said, okay, I'm done. Because, you know, I knew, I felt like I was good, but their auditions when I first started auditioning didn't match my talents. Right. It'd be this strange thing called three through the door. We walked through a revolving door, came up, and performed a character. And I'm not a big character guy.
Right.
So it was just useless. And I knew that they wrote out of improv, and I could audition where I could show my skills, you know? So I just gave up on them. I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, that was the major leagues. I'm like, well, screw that. I'm just going to do my own thing. And so, you know, ended up doing The Family, and that was great. You know, they were doing such really interesting stuff and great, great improv. And
what did it feel like to do
really interesting shows?
I'm sorry, Ian. I want to know what it felt like to do a family show. Like, if you could describe, like, or, you know, when I've been on improv teams that have been doing well, like, it feels like you each kind of have a job. Not always, like, you're not strictly defined to it, but you tend to fit into a certain, you know, you fit into the machine in a certain way. Did The Family feel like that, or was it, I don't know, I'd like to hear what it felt like to perform on that team when it was really at its height.
Well, at its height, most of us had worked together in the UCB. I'm sorry. I left out Miles Stroff of that UCB. That was the UCB. That's The Family.
Yeah, Miles Stroff is
another guy in The Family. Not in Leaf Enough, because we weren't talking about The Family. We were talking about UCB.
Right.
But what was it like in those days? Well, it was like I'll never have chemistry like that with people. It goes over in ASCAT when you see Walsh and Besser and me. I guess that must be that same chemistry, because I've been working with those guys, you know, 10 years and
right.
15 years, you know, but back when The Family was going on, we were rehearsing Upright Citizens Brigade and performing Upright Citizens Brigade, rehearsing with Del Close, you know, greatest improv director there is,
right.
Performing those shows and hanging out socially all the time. And as you know, improvisers, you're just doing bits. So it was crazy. Like, I don't know many people. I tell people, if you want to be really good at improv, minimum, you got to be rehearsing 3 times a week. And almost nobody does that, because it's hard to make that commitment,
yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
And harder in New York and L.A., because I think people are getting more professional work. Back in Chicago, there was hardly anything available.
Yeah.
So we were free all the time and working dirtbag jobs. And I was a doorman, a substitute teacher.
So were you guys rehearsing 3 times a week with The Family?
Oh, easily, you know, and then working with Dell multiple times a week. You say, I'm saying at the height, when we did these two shows, one was called Free Mad Rituals, the other one was called Dynamite Fun Nest. And that's the best we ever got. The way we have Herald Night at UCB, that's the way everything was at IO. There were no other shows but Herald's when we got there. And when I went on a house team, we performed, I think, every night that there were shows, we performed. And I guess we rehearsed some at that time, you know. But then, you know, we pulled Dell out of, you know, sort of directing retirement. He hadn't put up a show for a long time. He said, hey, will you work with us, you know, and we really want to get together. And so at that time, we were just with each other constantly, just drilling comedy one way or another, you know, and just having a blast. It was so much fun. We're all, you know, marginally employed, just tons of free time, everybody living in basically like hovels. I don't think anybody paid more than about $300 rent. Turn around filming videos in the day, you know, and back then, hilarious. Because at the very beginning of filming videos, it was so primitive that you had to know everything you were going to shoot and just shoot it in order, like know your cuts ahead of time, so just stop filming and then film the next thing. Then we all chipped in. This is a huge UCB investment. Everyone put in, I think, $200 to buy this $600 big device where you put two videotapes in, and it had a little dial you could turn so you could get the tape to just the right part and then play and record it on the other tape. So that was like primitive editing, you know, from tape to tape, and that was a big deal. But, you know, we did video stuff, and
when did
if that answers you.
When did Amy get involved?
A few years after, because she's younger than us, pretty much. It might have, the first show, I think, was Thunderball that she was in.
Yeah.
Which was kind of like the last one before we start putting up some really just straight-ahead sketch shows.
Right.
Because then we started getting, we kind of changed. You know what it was? We had people come to see shows, and they would just be baffled. I know the one, someone like MTV or somebody wanted to put together a sketch show, and they came and saw Thunderball. And it's so funny because I think they were used to people who were being seen being so industry-driven, wanting to get something from it.
Right.
And so we just... What do you do with that? It was four guys giving talk as a promoter, me as the star athlete, Amy as one of the cheerleaders, and Horatio Sands comes. We went down to, because it was right next to the Wrigley side, it was right next to Wrigley Field. So we walked over and then did this thing where the ghost of Shoeless Joe showed up, and that was Horatio Sands, and he read from the Bible. So it was just like, what?
Yeah.
And so I think we realized we have to do more straight ahead sketch, And so then that was me, Amy, Matt Besser, Matt Walsh. We put together. I mean, that's where the UCB really, what everyone thinks of, really starts,
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so everybody was there from the beginning of everything that leads to what we do now. That's the group that came out to New York.
Yeah.
We got two shows together, and we came to New York. We just hit the ground running because we got in two different theaters, put up both sketch shows, got another theater to improvise at, and then did Lou in the Lounge almost every whatever day of the week that was.
Monday. Yeah.
So you could see us four nights a week somewhere in New York. And within a year, we got the TV show. And we felt like, well, you guys, all of a sudden you were here, and then everyone knew about you. But it was because, people come out now. We have students that come to us, some of them in their teens, but like almost everybody about 22, like right out of college. And we had spent all that time out in Chicago. So when we came, we're like, we're not, we did all our playing around. It's just now, boom, we're looking to get a show,
Yeah.
So it came out with a game plan. And, well, we came out because of that, because we went from Chicago and just did a showcase in New York, and then everyone liked it, but, hey, some people didn't see it. They'd like to see you again. So within, 2 weeks later, we flew back out and did another show. And then we talked. We went to a little diner next to the Intel Olympic and just said, look, guys, I think we need to go to either New York or L.A. And then we chose New York because we thought our best bet was to be able to be seen anytime, so people just come see us any night of the week, come see us any week. L.A. was about, renting a theater for showcases. And
yeah.
So we chose New York. And it was rough, It was because Walsh has all his family out in Chicago, and Amy was just about to go on a stage at Second City. And, Walsh and I, because we had to all go, Matt, Walsh, Amy, and I had to go and talk to Kelly Leonard, say, hey, I'm going to go. And he was, he's the artistic director, I guess, at Second City, and say, look, we're going to go out to New York, we're trying to get a show. And he said, seen it before. Everybody thinks they're going to get a show. You're making a big mistake.
Wow.
Oh, well, we're going. But the four of us just decided. And we kind of made 6 month commitments and then re-upped. And so during that time, nobody would take anything that would take them away. Because Amy also had to walk away from a $10,000 kind of holding deal or something. At the time, Jim Sharp was working, I think, not with Comedy Central, but somewhere else. And we were trying to put a sketch show together, a cast, a sketch show. And they liked Amy. And Amy said, no, I'm going to give this a try. And so I believe she turned down some money. Anyway, someday if you interview Amy, you can ask her about that. But But it was, you know, so we made a six-month commitment, and you'd re-up, and during that time, it's like, you're not going to take anything that would make you walk away from the group, because that was the big thing that happened. Good groups, all anyone did was cherry-pick them and get people and put them up.
Yeah.
To get on. Because our feeling, and I still feel that, the best sketch shows are an ensemble that chose to be together and has worked together, as opposed to a cap, you know, an ensemble that gets cast and thrown together.
Right.
So when you were putting the TV show together, the TV show was very much modeled after a Harold, right?
Totally. That was our big pitch.
Go ahead.
You see, it comes back in these callbacks at the actual thing to sell. Also, this wraparound at the UCB.
Ian, can you say that again? Can you say that again? Our connection dropped while you were saying that.
Oh, oh shit.
Hey, sorry about that. Our call dropped.
Can you just say again the process of pitching a Harold-like sketch show to the network and how that went over?
Oh, we went in with cards with all the different sketches and showed how they would come back with second beats and then how they would wrap up and come together at the end. And, it was kind of amusing to Dave Becky, our manager at the time, because it was a very complicated sort of pitch. You know, it was like presenting a math problem to them. And we also had the element of the UCB, you know, framing it. But the big concept existed. Seinfeld, you could kind of make a case. You know, they have these three plot lines that come together. Pulp Fiction was something you could sort of say, you know, Pulp Fiction, three storylines, and they all end up touching each other and coming together at the end. So we just try to get this concept across, and it wasn't the easiest concept to get people on board with.
Yeah.
That's actually you touched on the UCB characters. What's the origin of those four characters? Were they something that you had before?
There was always this kind of joke that the UCB, that there was an evil corporation, an Uber corporation called the Russell Corporation. UCB was a subsidiary of them, the Upright Citizens Brigade, and we used to do these kind of video things, which made it seem that we were part of some horrible organization that polluted things and controlled people's minds. And virtual reality, the first show we did, it kind of fit with that because we were taking people into this false reality, which seems, you know, it seems a little insidious and dangerous that you might, you know, give up on the real world and go into this fantasy world. And so it was, that's the way it first originated. It was kind of like this concept that this comedy show was really this group looking to control your mind and make you disciples of them. And then it changed into us being more good guys who were doing screwed up stuff, interesting and exciting, and that we were the cool ones against the establishment, you know, which at first it was played like we were an arm of the establishment, smiling and being positive, but really looking to, right, to, you know, control everybody. So it evolved over time and became ultimately, at first it was just us all wearing suits, because we used to have a slogan, dress like the enemy.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of being anarchists who try to portray themselves as the establishment, and they're trying to, you know, overthrow the world. And it kind of fit what we were doing because we felt like that's kind of what we were doing with the shows, you know. Supposedly you come to a theater show, but you're leaving the theater and you're doing all this weird stuff, and we try to trick them, you know, do stuff with plants where you really try to convince people. Like one of those would be we had the best improv singer, improv song, the audience, and he would really harangue her to, come on, give up your day so I can improvise off it. And it would come up that she'd had an abortion that day. And the audience would really buy it and go, oh my God. And he would make me didn't hear it because she'd say it so quietly on her voice. Well, sorry, I couldn't hear you. People were like, no, just wanting to stop. she had an abortion. And then it would go, and then they'd get it because then we'd go through and everybody else would come to Walsh and me, and our days had to do with abortions too. You know,
I wanted to jump back real quick and touch on something that you mentioned. You were talking about how with Second City, you're not really a character guy. What kind of a guy do you consider yourself to be? Like, what do you think your strength as an improviser is?
As an improviser, I'd say being logical and real, you know, and hopefully funny by way of doing those things. But my main thing is just to commit completely, whether the other guy is kind of doing the outrageous stuff. In that case, then I just play exactly and try to be exactly what would I do if this really was happening, you know. And that's what I push people when I teach. It's like, can you really, what would you really do? Because I always think that's the funniest, the more it's exactly your reaction, even if it meant you have to leave the scene, because the other person will do the work to keep you there, you know. But and then if I'm the outrageous one, is to know all the logic of why would I feel this way and commit to that. It's not a comedy thing. It's not a joke. It's because you meet people in life who have completely wrong-headed views, and they didn't set out that day to be an idiot or be wrong. You know, they believe. They really believe.
And when
they're justified.
When you say you commit to, like, what you would, when you're playing a straight character, like, what you would really do, you're talking about you, Ian Roberts, what you would actually do in that situation.
Right. Unless for some reason I'm a character, which is not too likely because that would be two unusual things in the scene. You know, usually the other person's being unusual. And I'd say that my theory of comedy in general is that everything that is not the unusual thing should be exactly what it would be in life. And that goes outside of improv. You know, if you're doing sketch, you know, if you're, say, filming sketch, you want everything to look real. I can't stand when, for the purposes of comedy, anything is otherwise do it. You know, I don't want the lighting brighter. I don't want the sets goofy. I don't want people having strange hair or costume. It just has everything, unless that is what's supposed to be unusual. Boom. You know, I'd say the biggest virus in currently is ironic detachment, you know, in comedy. It's just, I despise it. To me, it ruins stuff. You have a perfectly good concept when people are acting, you know, in a strange way, you know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Have a seat, Johnson. I need to talk to you about, unless for some reason that's the thing of the scene, you know, if the guy is some kind of bizarre boss you've never seen in the world, you know.
Do you think that that's lack of commitment or lack of training?
I didn't hear you.
Sorry.
You cut out. Lack of what?
Do you think that that comes from lack of commitment or lack of training or a little bit of both?
Well, on one level, I'd say that there's a lot of people are being fed on that. So, I mean, the same way you're going to do whatever culture you come from, you're going to have the customs of that culture, the habits of that culture. I think people are being brought up now on, YouTube videos by amateur people. And there's just this, because I see it, what I've really been exposed to, because my daughter's a big fan of YouTube comedy. And I watch it, and it's, you know, it's big and broad, and everybody's ironic. And kind of, there's a lot of it's coming off of the fact that the comedy's being done instead of trying to suck you into the fiction of a situation. You're very aware that these are some people goofing around with the camera. And I think that that is bleeding over into people that want to do this professionally, you know. I mean, not across the board. And, you know, I don't get out that much now that I've got kids, and so I don't get around the theater as much as a lot of people. But sometimes I see stuff and I'm like, God, that would be really good if you just get into it and allow me to suspend my disbelief, because I think things are so much funnier. You know, that thing we talk about, you know, Blue doesn't show up well on Blue. I mean, if comedy is kind of the distance between expectation and reality, that's usually why something's funny to us in life, because our expectations, it would go this way, instead this happens. Well, if you don't have the expectation surrounding the comedy, if what you expected, and that's talk like a human being, walk like a human being, react as you would react. You know, that like the one thing we say is like, you know, someone pulls a.
We're having a little trouble with
Ian,
the connection.
Sorry, wait.
About to see. Yeah, well, not sure how long goes off the connection, but I was talking about, you know, like a real easy example to show this that comes up is someone will pull a gun in an improv setting.
Right.
And the other person goes, what are you pulling a gun for? Come on. I just want you to go to the store with me. And you're like, wait, stop. What would you do? And it's much, you know, in my mind, it's much funnier if you give full reaction. And then that other person who pulled the gun, you know, outrageously inappropriate, will then let you know why they think it's fine, you know. But if you just let things, you know, so I guess that's why it's important to have everything that's not the unusual thing be just as we would expect it to be. And that means, you know, being as relatively intelligent as everybody is and caring about the kind of things you care about and, you know, acting like a human being.
What's important to you about the theater? Or let me put it this way. Like, when you guys were founding the theater, or maybe even now, what would you like, you know, in a perfect world, what would you like the theater to be and to represent? And what would you, if you could just snap your fingers and have it be so?
Well, at the whole half, I think it is what we want it to be and what I want it to represent.
Yeah.
So I don't have to snap my fingers and make it that way. But what it was all about is we got a lot of headaches and disrespect. First of all, you're a young group with no following. You have to rent the theater, and no one knows you, so no one's going to come to your shows. Why would they? And so we had that situation where we're renting a place for $300. We got four people came to see the show at $5 each. It cost us $280 to do a show, you know. And so that's one thing we wanted to exist for people, is something where the banner under which you're performing recommends your show. So I think that's a great thing we didn't have when we came to New York City, is there wasn't a place where we could get the imprint of the place on our show, and that would say, oh, okay, it's probably, it's at least worth taking a look. So I think shows at our theater, they almost always get a decent audience. You know, just people say, oh, this, I feel like going to the theater, going to UCB to stay the week, I'll give it a shot. This stuff's usually pretty good. And that didn't exist. So that's one thing. The other thing was, so that's why we have all the way we run our theaters off of what we wanted, what we would have liked. So nobody pays to rent the space. Conversely, nobody is paid. That is that the shows that have a reputation are subsidizing the shows that don't have a reputation. And we've had very little understanding that a few times people have been, you know, we should start getting paid. You know, we're really bringing in the audience here. And it's like, guys, when you first came here, no one knew you were going to be superstars and you were going to be this big draw. So you got to understand, you know, your show, but there's been so little of that. And I think that's, you know, that's a very cool thing. Keeping prices, another thing was we want people in the seats. You want to be seen. And so we've never thought of the theater part as some big money-making enterprise. You know, $5 a week for weekdays, and then slowly we've gone up to what? Are we $10 now on weekends?
Yeah.
You know, we realize you have to compete with movies. And movies are pretty awesome. So if you can go see a movie for, you know, $10, you got to be able to see a show for $10, or, you know, how are you going to compete? And so our theory was we'd rather have 20 people in the seats at $5 than 10 people in the seats at $10. You know?
Yeah.
So just get people there. What are the theories? I mean, one of the reasons for getting a theory was just realizing common sense. We were at that place, Solo Arts, and we just did the math and realized that between all the shows we were doing there, the money we were spending to rent space from them for classes and the other people that were doing shows there because we were paying their rent. So you just logically say, well, this is crazy. We should have our own place because we're paying the rent. Kind of place where people can see props. That was something people would give us a headache about. You can't have any props here. We're like, what are you kidding? And so, you know, you can have props at our theater. It's all supposed to be friendly to the performers,
right?
You know? And then the other thing is just to have a kind of unified theory of comedy behind the theater. You know, lots of the people that perform at the theater have also trained with us. And so there's a common vocabulary. And you get together with someone, you're like, oh, everyone's title. What's the game of the scene? What's the game of the team? And that works for everything. Like, what's the game of this show, basically? You've got a concept for the show. Well, if this, then what? If this, then what? And so that's another thing. That's been fun because now you get on other projects and people talk about game, you know? So that vocabulary, I think, is coming into, I mean, I think probably in 10 years, I think everybody that does comedy will talk about, hey, what's the game of this?
And that's, you know? That kind of opens up a ton of questions that I would like to ask you. But let me start with one about how do you, looking back on it, the UCB has become this huge movement. You know, two theaters, one in New York, one in L.A., thousands of people, hundreds of people, if not more, want to take classes and want to study this this art form that, or this philosophy that you have helped to solidify. So looking back on it and thinking about, you know, starting in Chicago and now making this big movement, how do you feel about that?
Good. I don't know. It is important to us, you know. Like, we feel, when it comes down to stage improv, by the way, you know, we always say our theater is a comedy theater, not an improv theater. But it so happens the rules of improv underpin all good comedy. You know, and I feel I could defend that point if I had to. You know, you could bring up example after example and I'd say, well, that has this game, this has this game, this has this game. And so we want people to, you know, like, we're fairly dogmatic, but I'm always defending that because we're dogmatic like someone who insists that you agree that there's gravity. Are dogmatic. You know, I mean, I just feel there's nothing wrong. It is the game, the game. If then, that's comedy. And so we're very, you know, there can be this touchy-feely thing in improv, like, hey, there's a place for everything. And we kind of really don't feel that way. If your approach to improv is, say the first thing that comes out of your mouth, be free, you know, just release your subconscious, I say, no, I completely disagree with you, you know, and improv isn't, hey, everyone, there's a place for everything, everything's okay, not really, call it something else, or if you want to hang out and do this thing, but you're not going to do the best comedy if you don't understand that there's a formal aspect to it, you know, and so that's getting out there and becoming bigger and bigger, I'm very happy with that, you know, that so people aren't just... Don't just luck into it. Like, I would never be running a school. I always say that. I never, because I've been at schools that I feel were a sham. Not with improv. You know, I think Improv Olympic was good and I learned stuff. But with acting, I have. I know I have. You know, I've been in places where the people are tricking you. They're people that they're not succeeding enough as actors, so they need a source of income. So they teach classes and they don't know how to teach you how to act because there's no form behind it. Like, a piano teacher doesn't know to explain to you that these notes represent keys on the piano and says, okay, just get the piano and thump away, man. Just whatever you're feeling, do it. You're not going to learn to play piano that way,
right?
You know? And so I feel we're not, that there is a, well, you'd be better, you know, and dependably do good comedy. So it's a big deal to me that that's out there. And I'm willing to defend it and debate it with people. You know, I never feel there's anything wrong. Like I said, that dogmatic thing, it can really rub people with improv and think, well, improv, free flowing. Like, yes, but jazz, you know, jazz musician will tell you that there are rules. You know, it's not just going on a tangent forever and doing anything you want. That'd just be gobbledygook. You know, it does return to themes. It does, you know, so I feel good about that, and I think it's something positive that's come into the community, and people can have a common language and know they can communicate and work with each other and have a shorthand is a great thing, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about you writing. The reason I want to ask about this is I'm curious, people who have spent a lot of time doing improv and they form a lot of their ideas in the context of improv – and then they move to a different medium. I'm curious what, if anything, stays with you or what are the common things? I mean, I've talked to people who have gone from improv to stand-up, and I've had interesting conversations over how a lot of the mantras of improv...
Well, yeah. You still there?
Yeah.
I can't speak to improv stand-up. I would imagine it would work because, again, I would think within jokes, to keep riffing on a joke, it would be if-then. If this is true, what else goes along these lines? But I've said for the longest time, and it's a way of kind of almost saying, hey, to be honest with you, if you're here for this as an acting class, I think it's more a writer's tool than an actor's tool, what we teach. I think that those skills of being able to ask and answer the question if, then, and find a game is exactly what writing is. And the reality of acting is that you have a script and it's interpretive. So if pure acting isn't an improvisation, is a creative art form. You know, you have to make content. And there's no difference when you write, since there are no words on the page before you start, you're necessarily improvising. It's different than if I'm playing music. Again, I'd say that playing off of sheet music is an interpretive art. How can you play this? And despite the fact that the notes are absolutely set, there are great pianists and run-of-the-mill pianists, so there's definitely an interpretive element to it. But, you know, with writing, it's improvisation, it's creating. And so I use that skill absolutely, especially if what you're writing is comedy. If you're writing comedy, there's no way you're not using improv. Exactly, if that. I use it all the time.
And you,
you
do
know,
a lot
so
of,
when I'm doing a movie.
Sorry, you do a lot of punch-up work, right, on screenplays?
With a punch-up, mostly, I write and sell my own stuff. And,
okay.
And punch-up is probably not even 0.1%.
You know, okay. But, I thought you might have been doing more of it than you are.
No, I do some. You know, sometimes you get a job, you go in, you do a tip for the people. But, no, it's mostly I do office hours. I go in every day, do about 4 to 5 hours. I write with a partner, and it's basically all improv. Whether we're breaking the story, you know, trying to come up with a plot, it's still, well, what else would happen? It's the, like right now, you know, should I not have a question? Should I something I haven't? But, you know, we've had stuff like about a movie where a CEO is a silver spoon kid who, you know, was born on third base, you know, and thinks he hit a triple, that kind of thing. And so he's rich. He's the head of a corporation, but he's completely insubstantial. And so you write a movie. What would happen if this guy lost everything he had and had to try to get back up? But that's just a never-ending asking the question, if then. If you're insubstantial, you've been given everything, do you understand how to make money? Do you understand how to manage money? Do you have any real friends? You know, does anybody really respect you? If you lost your money, what would happen? You know, and with comedy, you think up tons of comic situations off that. And then the character, you also get character games. And so you know how that person would respond if presented with this. If trying to achieve this, if, you know, so I think it's absolutely, completely applicable to comedy writing. You know, you couldn't do it without it. So whether you've been taught formally or not, you're definitely using game if you're successfully writing comedy. That's the same thing like, say, sitcom writing. They just know the game of the character. I'm the stupid guy on the show. You know, I'm Woody behind the bar. Refill the game. What would Woody contribute to trying to solve this problem? How would he misunderstand this? And it just, you're playing game, you know?
What do you feel your strengths are, or what are you most comfortable with as a writer? You know, like we talk about what you contribute as an improviser. If you are working with someone, working on a script, what do you bring into the table?
Logic, again, as always, you know, which is funny, but the not super fun or comedy creating part of the job, but you have to come up with logical stories. And I think thing of asking those questions, being logical, you know, analytical, and then simply providing dialogue, because all I do when I write is I say out loud what the character would say. And when I reread it, you read it and it just doesn't fit. What would I say? And so I'm completely acting it. You know, it's not like Yeah, God, it would be, you know, Mom, I know, you know that I love you. Why would I, you know, I'm going to be acting it. No. What? You know that I love you. Look, let's just, you know what I mean? I'm just, you know.
Right.
And then you write it down. So I've never written, I have to sometimes, you know, written out of my head, just into my hands. But even that, I'm hearing the voice in my head. You know, I'm improvising. So, yeah, my improv skills to find the game, to write dialogue, write funny dialogue, and then those same skills to do the more technical part, like breaking the story. You know, so, well, what would happen? And if we're trying to serve this concept, if we know we're going here, if you know the final point of the movie is going to be, you know, things finally work out when you put family first. If that's true, then what journey would get him to that conclusion?
Right.
And so, first of all, try to come to the comedy and getting it wrong, not putting the family first. Then, well, what would happen that would make him have the turn? It's all asking those logical questions.
I would guess that a lot of your – another thing I bet you that having Ian Roberts brings – that maybe this isn't true, but just from watching your improv for years – is like an attraction to sort of like dark subjects. I feel like with Martin and Orloff and just stuff that you laugh at most when you were like a teacher and you would watch scenes. I feel like you're really drawn to like, you know, disturbing things taken very seriously and then put in a ridiculous context. Like, and I think Martin and Orloff is the best example.
I'm sure that's tempered by commercial expectations,
yeah.
You know? Like, for instance, that one I just threw out at you about the CEO, it was pretty bizarre and out there. I wouldn't say I necessarily love dark, because I don't think I'm ever trying to shock. I talked about ironic detachment being a problem with young kids. Another problem I can see is just trying to be outrageous for outrageous sake.
Right.
And I don't like that. I mean, it's got to be wrong-headed mistakes a real human being might make, taken to an extreme, you know. And I do love that. You know what I love? I love humiliation. You know, in a great mainstream movie, like I would think Meet the Parents is just a really kind of pinnacle of mainstream Hollywood movie getting it right.
Yeah,
that makes me laugh so hard because the guy can't win for losing. It's just everything's misinterpreted, and he makes such a fool of such horrible. I love Cringeworthy. I love The Office. You know,
yeah.
Someone caught in a bold faced lie, stuff like that. You know, when things are real, you know, I think that's great. And those kind of things I admire. That might not be what I do too. I recently went down a YouTube wormhole watching old comedians like Jack Benny and Bob Hope.
Right.
And I'll tell you, I curse all the time when I improvise, and you know the stuff we do. We're always raping someone in the ass, and you know, I don't know, slitting the Pope's throat or whatever. It's like, yeah, it is funny, but these guys could just, you know, it's probably what I'm not great at. Like, those guys are just great timing comedians, you know. Like the guy I probably like the most in mainstream comedy. Oh, I don't know. I like lots of guys. But one guy I respect, maybe it's because it's what I would like to do, and it's what I'd have the best chance of doing if I could be as good as he is Ben Stiller.
Yeah.
You know, because he does a lot of straight man comedy, and I tend to respect that and enjoy that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have a great bewildered face.
Yeah.
I feel like one of my favorite things when I was sort of coming up at UCB or first coming to see a lot of shows would see the ridiculous things at ASCAT, and you just absolutely bewildered and flummoxed by whatever was going on. There was some scene I remember where it was a very like chaotic and loud and fun show. This is
hey, Will, you're, I'm sorry, Will, you're cutting out. I couldn't hear what you said.
Okay. You got me now?
Yeah.
A scene I loved from a long time ago, there was four – this is like from 22nd Street. I forget who was in the scene, but you were in it. And it was four people in a car, and somebody in the back seat slices the throat of the driver – and you were in the other back seat, and I can't remember. It was definitely implied that you should then also slice the throat of the other passenger. I forget why. It was like some kind of pattern or something. And like I remember you like looked around completely confused, and you said out loud, "Today is the day I become a man," and then you sliced the throat. Like you needed to make it some justification over why you would do it? Like why would you do such a crazy thing? So you kind of like that was your throwaway, like 1 second justification of why you would commit murder from a scene that had been placid like 10 seconds before. But it was it was super hilarious. It was great. I mean, the whole show was great. But your face during that was
It's funny when you write scripts, it's a fault of ours. You know, they get bought, but sometimes it's hard to get people to do because my writing partner and I both like a guy who's like the eye of the storm.
Yeah.
Who's kind of getting kicked around and buffeted. But a lot of big comedians guys don't want to do that. And I understand it. They want to be funny. Now, for me, I think, oh, did I find that so funny? And I think it's so valuable because your reaction is, to me, is what it's making everything else funny. If it was if everybody else rolled with what the outrageous people were doing, well, then who cares? But what's funny is that straight man reminded you, oh, wait, this is the world we live in, this stuff is happening in.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's not so much like a rush. It's not so much the rush to be funny as it is like the rush to, like, you have to establish that reality and play real within it.
Well, it's funny, and I'm not saying I feel like I'm making some big selfless sacrifice. I find that really funny. So I never, you know, if I don't feel relegated to the straight man role. I mean, that's hilarious. Like, if people are tagging, I mean, improv people are tagging out one after another to go kick me around for more in service of the game. You know, oh, if this happens to this guy, if people have misinterpreted his actions and they're all angry at him, this happens, I love being there, you know, just being there. And, but it's funny, I don't know how great I am when it comes to acting it. You know, like I say, I admire Ben Stiller because I think he's just hilarious, you know, hilarious at doing that. And that he's willing to shows he respects that, you know.
Yeah, I think it's that commitment. It's the commitment that you talked about earlier that makes you particularly strong at acting that stuff. It's the commitment that you talked about before that I think makes you such a strong actor in those situations.
Mm-hmm. That's good, yeah. Yeah, get as angry as you would get, be as bewildered as you would get. Like, you know, we even try, I know in class sometimes, with people, we try to figure it out. Like, what are the levels of this? And they talk about, they have that thing like the 7 levels of something, like when you find out you're going to die, you know, with denial or this and that. Like, your first thing just might be if someone... Like, for instance, comes to me, not crazy, completely lost, abducted by aliens. I can imagine it would take 4 steps, ending in disaster. Dear Lord, this turns the world upside down. The world before there was proof of aliens, the world after, you know what I mean? But the first thing would be, someone said, I got abducted by aliens last night. I'd assume anybody I know probably likes comedy, and I'd say, whatever, I'd joke back with them, I'd, you know, ignore them, I don't know, whatever. And they'd say, no, really? I think, oh, they're pushing it. And then I'd be, come on. And I'd think, well, okay, you believe it, but there's some explanation. You know what I mean? You go through all these levels. And I think going through those levels, whatever they are, whatever exactly is always right, whatever you would exactly do, how can it be wrong? That's got to be right. And I would say to people, because I would tell them this good news, bad news thing. The good news is, the bad news, I'd start with the bad news. The bad news is, to be great at anything, you know, the Russians have shown, you recruit the kid at 7 years old because they have this aptitude, and you just drill them in the thing until they're the best in the world at it. So I think it's the way most things go. Like, I don't think great pianists, great dancers, great ball players, you know, they don't start when they're 22. And so that's the bad news is like, hey, if you haven't been intuitively doing this already, maybe you're not going to have superstar abilities of yes-anding and if-thening. But the one thing you've done your whole life necessarily is you have reacted to exactly as you would react truthfully to all situations every day of your life. And that is fully 50% of improv. So you can be a valuable member of any team because I've seen people who weren't the funniest people in the world, but the great people that everyone on the ensemble likes and enjoys, and they play top of their intelligence, and they fit in just fine. If you were a jerk and you tried to break it down, you might say, you know, not as funny, these guys are funny, but it's an ensemble. And who the hell cares? That person can be completely valuable to the team, and no one knows any different watching the show. But maybe they don't drive scenes as much as the other people on the team, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, because I try to tell people, you know, they might feel they're struggling. It's like, well, maybe just find your place. You know, you can definitely learn to react. There's no doubt that it has to be true that you can learn to, on stage, react top of your intelligence and truthfully, because you've practiced your whole life. It's getting out of your way. Whereas, you know, it's almost stupid kind of improv teaching. Like, just do the first thing. In terms of reaction to top of your intelligence, that's kind of true. Can you get in touch with precisely what you would do? You know, and that is almost getting out of your own way. The other part is not getting out of your own way. It's drilling these techniques into the second nature to, you know, to thought that's not a completely natural thing, because we're exaggerating reality. You're narrowing things down, you're becoming, I don't know, more two-dimensional, you know what I mean? They are, but people you can imitate, I always say that, in a way, they have a game. They are, in a way, limited people. They're predictable, and so people imitate them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's because they have a game by way of narrowing down their reactions. Like, if they're just such an angry person that everything sets them off, you can imitate them, because they're closer to a comedy character, which in comedy, you know, we take away options. We start, you know, we stop doing yes and going broader and adding, and we just limit it. No, nothing, I don't want anything in this scene now, but stuff to fix this pattern, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian.
Yeah, it's fun. I always like talking about it, guys.
Yeah, we love, I mean, I could honestly talk to you about this for 5 more hours, and I think we're going to have you back, because there's a ton of questions that I wanted to ask you that I didn't get to.
Yeah, we could do another whole one just on stuff you've taught on workshops, and you come out here, and, you know, probably when you get to do workshops in L.A. So
maybe we'll come back.
I will say that one of the best improv classes I took was when you... One of the best classes that I've taken was from you when you were doing a 400 level class at the Old Space, and it was all improv based in truth. And that is stuff that I still use today. Like, you would make us, one thing that you would have us do is, like, we'd do a two-person scene, and we would have to raise our hand whenever we said something that was actually true from our lives. And that stuff was amazing to me.
It's funny, you know, I forget these things. It's interesting to hear.
It sounds like common sense, but yeah, your classes definitely make students have more faith that the real answer is interesting.
That's it,
and
yes.
You don't have to work so hard if you can just have your real life come easily to mind as like a more powerful weapon than you might imagine when you're first studying improv.
Well, that's just it's one thing. It's kind of my obsession. I don't teach enough to see it through, but I've become obsessed with this exercise. It's come to me late in the game. But it's the flash. I'm sure when I come up to New York, it's what I choose to do usually, because it's what it interests me so much. But if you do this thing where someone says a line, the other person has to get in touch with the first thing that flashed in their mind when that person said what they said, and then fashion a fictional line using that information.
Yeah.
Because, whatever, and I try to explain it that if you guys really knew each other, you could imagine that the conversation you had, if there were thought bubbles above your head, you share a thought bubble.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, say, this interview later, 2 days from now. So remember when you said that, I think of myself sitting in this chair, saying it, and, you know, and then when you improvise, it's like two thought bubbles that you superimpose over each other. So when you talked to Syria, which had the horrible, rude woman who served the fries. And so when I yes-and you, I bring in this specific of this horrible, rude woman that serves the fries. And now that becomes a reality in your world. And you can imagine if we were really having this conversation and we really had a relationship, we would both know that. So you superimpose our thought bubbles, and it makes a very truthful scene. And whatever you think, whatever their line makes you think of, it necessarily works. How could it not? Because it was, you thought of it because of what they said. And so, yeah, it's this great exercise that makes you, if you could really get to that, and I think it's what most of us that improvise fairly well do, right away, we're quick at whatever your line connoted to me, using it when I respond to the person.
Yeah.
And saying, once you find the game, so now you're doing a game. Say it's the simplest game in the world. You're misusing implements in the kitchen.
Right.
So, in a way, kitchen now is in your mind. And so some kitchen you're going to use, whether it's a commercial kitchen you worked in, the kitchen at your house now, and that's where you're going to get the implements to plug into the game and misuse them, you know? So if you can be aware of that flash, this is my reality of what we're talking about, and no one knows the difference. The audience doesn't know you're talking about, you know? So two guys are talking about their dad. If both of you build the dad with fictional elements of your dad, it's going to seem very real and very specific and probably be a lot funnier.
Right.
I also feel that when you're specific, it makes things universal because the things, let it be done. Okay. All right. Talk to you later, guys.
All right. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Ian.
Okay.
Bye, Ian.
All right. Bye now.
Well, that was Ian Roberts, one of the co-founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade and the reason that we're all here.
Yes.
And so thanks for listening. Also, I wanted to mention, I forgot to mention, we're nominated for an ECNY award.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So thank you very much to everyone who voted for us. And now you have to go to the website and vote so that we can win.
That's right, ecnyawards.com/vote.
Because now that we're nominated for it, I actually want to win it.
Right, that's right. You'd probably be here dismissing any award that we weren't nominated for.
Oh, totally. I can't stand the Oscars.
Right.
So... Yeah, thanks for nominating us for that. Please go vote for us. Thank you if you already have. And thanks for listening. We apologize for the choppy Skype connection.
We're still learning that technology, but it was worth it, I think, to get Ian and to talk to him.
Yeah.
One of the founders, a really interesting and funny dude. So
I felt so delicate during that interview, you know?
You did?
I did. It's hard to talk to somebody over a computer. I know. Harder than it is to talk to somebody in person.
We're going
to
improve that technology. But
personally are?
I'm going to get into the cables in the ground and make it better. But thanks for bearing with it. I think it was worth it to have a good talk with an interesting dude.
So, it was absolutely worth it.
But yeah, thanks for putting up with the skips and stuff.
Okay, and so we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.